My name is Jim Brandt, and this session is one in a series which is entitled Conversations with Fellow Travelers. And today our person, our fellow traveler that we're going to have here with us is Frederick Buechner. And we will have him present with us by means of a videotape that we'll play down there in a little bit. Just a little bit about myself. This is my first time visiting Holden, and so my first time ever teaching here. And it struck me today that this is something I always really wanted to do, and here I am doing it. And it's just sort of, it's really kind of exciting. I think I first heard of Holden when I was a student at St. Olaf some years ago, and knew that some of my professors there that I really admired. I think particularly of Howard Hong, who would come out here and teach, and so it's something I've really wanted to do. So it's fun for me. Although it made me nervous the first day too, you know, to sort of be here and in this special place and teach. My area of interest is, an area of work, is historical theology. So I am a historian, and I focus on Christian history. The previous two figures that I've done this week were Augustine and Julian of Norwich, and they are figures from our past. The figure we look at today in the next two sessions are figures from our present. So we don't have to do the kind of historical jumping that we did with the other ones. But in some ways that'll make it easier. Conversation, what central to the way I approach my own teaching is this notion of conversation. And that involves listening to each other and talking with each other, listening to the figures that we're drawing in this today, Frederick Buechner, and it involves listening to ourselves, listening to our own lives, listening to our hearts. And I've said this in one of the other sessions, but for me, I think that's something that it's real hard to do because my life is a busy life and I don't find time to contemplate, to listen to that still small voice within and what it may be trying to say to me. And part of the listening, the way we'll focus the listening today is to listening to our own stories and thinking about our families, particularly our families of origin, because the piece from the videotape that we're going to see, we'll hear Frederick Buechner talking about his family. And let me say one other thing about Frederick Buechner, and that is his most recent book, which actually is just a collection of pieces from different books that he's written. His most recent book is entitled Listening to Your Life. And it's sort of, I bought it for my wife and I think she started to read it. I haven't read it myself, but it's got a selection for each day of the year. And the idea is you can read a piece of Frederick Buechner every day. But I think the conviction that he works out of, which is one that I really share, is the conviction that we need to listen to our lives because our stories are sacred. That God has been and is at work in our lives in a lot of ways that we don't even know. And that's what one of the that's why it's so important, I think, to stop, to try to get in touch with our lives and try to ask, what are we feeling? And what are the struggles of our lives? And what are the ways that God has been with us to bring us thus far? So the conviction I have is that, as the German theologian Karl Rahner says, grace, God's grace, is always already at work. And that flies in the face of much in the tradition of Christian theology. Protestant or Catholic theology very often has been organized around the dichotomy between nature and grace. And it's as if our nature left by itself doesn't have grace to it. And much Protestant theology, our Lutheran theology, would be focused on sin and grace. And so it's as if there's sin and we're sinful and God's grace isn't at work yet. Well, Rahner is one of those who wants to say, no, God's grace is always already there, always already working with us and carrying us along. And because I share that kind of conviction, it leads me to the kind of attraction to Buechner and to the work that we're going to do today. Let's see. Oh, one of the things I have to say about Frederick Buechner is that he is a Presbyterian minister. And my wife was very careful to remind me that I needed to say that because my wife is also a Presbyterian minister. And so she wants to make sure the Presbyterians get their due today. Another thing by way of introduction that I want to say is that the issue that Buechner is going to address in the videotape has to do with families of origin, and it has to do with secrets in families of origin. Things that are present in the family, but for one reason or another, people in the family don't want to talk about it. What kind of things come to your mind when you think about secrets in families? What kind of things do...
Alcoholism.
Alcoholism can be a secret, can it? Sometimes we don't want to admit that it's present.
Divorce.
Divorce.
Suicide.
Wife
beating.
Yes.
Abuse
of one sort or another.
Child abuse.
I think anything you're embarrassed about, and I'm thinking about my parents who are elderly, and sometimes things go wrong, and my father will get financially taken advantage of. And I've tried to say, Dad, whatever happens, tell me, tell us, let us help you. Don't be embarrassed. The family should never be embarrassed, but they are. And I know sometimes they live far away, and I know sometimes things happen, and they don't want to tell me because they're embarrassed.
Yep, and so it can become something we don't talk about in our family. And it's going to be different from family to family, of course. My wife's a Presbyterian minister. I'm a Lutheran minister. I work in a Methodist context, so I like to think of myself as a very ecumenical sort of person. I teach in a Methodist seminary, St. Paul School of Theology, in Kansas City, Missouri. Being here at Holden with its Lutheran ethos, of course, is in some ways like coming home and feels real familiar, it also gets me thinking about my own family and Lutheran roots. And as I thought about my own family and secrets, I am a Missouri Synod exile. I grew up in the Missouri Synod. My father is a pastor, and he was a Missouri Synod pastor, and then left Missouri Synod in the Troubles. Both of my grandfathers were Missouri Synod pastors. One of my great-grandfathers is a Missouri Synod pastor. Most of my uncles are pastors. And so, you know, it's one of those families that we've got just coming out our ears. And here I am, an oldest son, and I'm a Lutheran pastor. But I was, as I thought about that and thought about secrets in my family and what kind of things can't we talk about, in some ways we've really been blessed. We have not had alcoholism or suicide that I know of. Financial things we can talk about pretty well. As I thought about it, it occurred to me that in my family, probably the most taboo subject would really be to say anything critical about our Lutheran tradition. I don't know if any of you can resonate with that, but I think that's really the way it is. And as I realized that in the last couple of days, I was trying to think, you know, what's that about and why is that, that in my family, we couldn't talk about it. And there's some reasons it started to float around in there, but I just wanted to share that with you by way of one example of a secret that operates. And I think in our discussion time, if you want to talk further about that, I'd be glad to, because ours probably isn't the only Lutheran family that's like that. So I just wanted to share that with you for your thoughts. I have some questions that I've written on the board, and I wanted to lay those out, because what I'd like to do now is move to this videotape of Frederick Buechner, and you on the tape end, I don't know what you're supposed to do, but I know you can't record it, so I don't know if they're listening up there, but let them figure it out. But after the videotape, what I'd like to do is get us into some small groups and talk together about the tape. And the questions I have, just to get you started, that you might think about as we watch the tape together, is what feelings does the videotape evoke in you? Do you know of a family which was able to become open about its secret? And try to think about how that was possible. And any application of the video to your own family of origin. So keep those questions in the back of your mind as we proceed here. And I did this yesterday. And if you want to move to get yourself into a place, I think both of these TVs will be on. And I was able to make the video machine work yesterday, but
to me, in my own experience, the place where, if indeed there is a God who speaks, the place where I've heard him speak most eloquently, most almost undeniably, is in things that have happened.
My story and Fred Buechner's story are identical. My story and Mother Teresa's story is identical. My story and Maxine Home Kingston's story, or Lee Poe, Carlos Fuentes, mystery between human beings.
Well, I know what a writer's looking for. He's looking for an experience of that oneness, that unity that is at the basis of our existence. As a person of faith, my assumption ahead of time is that that unity is there to be discovered.
Said James Carroll.
That's James Carroll. Yeah. And the other two figures that we're going to do in the other 2 days are James Carroll and Maya Angelou.
The 21st Trinity Institute Conference in New York and San Francisco was the setting for noted authors Frederick Buechner, Maya Angelou, and James Carroll to speak of their experiences of God with us. In part one of this video series, Sacred Stories, Frederick Buechner, author of such works as Godric and Brendan, revisits his childhood memories of his parents. Recounting a tragic event, Buechner reflects on its destructive impact on his life. By bringing the secrets of the past into the light, he discovers an opportunity to forgive, receive healing, and to reshape the future.
One November morning in the year 1936, when I was 10 years old, my father got up early, put on a pair of gray slacks and a maroon sweater, opened the door to look in briefly on my younger brother and me, who were playing a game in our room, and then went down into the garage where he turned on the engine of the family Chevy and sat down on the running board to wait for the exhaust to kill him, which it did. Except for a memorial for his Princeton class the next spring, by which time we had moved away to another part of the world altogether, there was no funeral, because on both my mother's and my father's side there was no church connection of any kind, and funerals were simply not part of the tradition. He was cremated, his ashes buried in a cemetery in Brooklyn, and I have no idea who, if anybody, was present. I know only that my mother, my brother, and I were not. There was no funeral to mark his death and put a period at the end of the sentence that had been his life. And as far as I can remember, once he had died, my mother and my brother and I rarely talked about him much ever again, either to each other or to anybody else. It made my mother too sad to talk about him. And since there was already more than enough sadness to go around, my brother and I avoided the subject with her, as she avoided it for her own reasons also with us. Once in a while she would bring it up, but only in very oblique ways. I remember her saying things like, "You're going to have to be big boys now," or, "Now things are going to be different for all of us, and to me, you're the man of the family now." With that one little three-letter adverb, "now," weighted with more grief and anger and guilt and God knows what all else than it could possibly bear. We didn't talk about my father and each other, and we didn't talk about him outside the family either, partly at least because suicide was looked on as something a little shabby and shameful in those days. Nice people weren't supposed to get involved with it. My father had tried to keep it a secret himself by leaving his note to my mother in a place where only she would be likely to find it, and by saying a number of times the last few weeks of his life that there was something wrong with the Chevy's exhaust system, which he was going to see if he could fix. He did this partly in hopes that his life insurance wouldn't be invalidated, which of course it was, and partly too, I guess, in hopes that his friends wouldn't find out how he died, which of course they did. His suicide was a secret we nonetheless tried to keep as best we could. And after a while, my father himself became such a secret. There were times when he seemed almost a secret we were trying to keep from each other. I suppose there were occasions when one of us said, "Remember the time he did this," or "Remember the time he said that," but if so, I've long since forgotten. And because words words are so much a part of what we keep the past alive by, if only words to ourselves, by not speaking what we remembered about him, we soon simply stop remembering himself, or at least I did. Within a couple of months of his death, we moved away from New Jersey, where he died, to the island of Bermuda, of all places, another house, another country. And from that point on, I can't even remember remembering him. Within a year of his death, I seem to have forgotten what he looked like, except for certain photographs of him, to have forgotten what his voice sounded like and what it had been like to be with him. Because none of the three of us ever talked about how we had felt about him when he was alive, or how we felt about him now that he was dead, those feelings soon disappeared too and went underground, along with the memories. As near as I can find out from people who knew him, he was a charming, good-looking, gentle man who was down in his luck, drank too much, and had a great number of people who loved him and felt sorry for him. Among those people, however inadequately they may have showed it, I can only suppose were his wife and two sons. But in almost no time at all, it was as if, at least for me, he had never existed. Don't talk. Don't trust. Don't feel. Is supposed to be the unwritten law of families that for one reason or another have gone out of whack. And certainly it was our law. We never talked about what had happened. We didn't trust the world with our secret, hardly even trusted each other with our secret. And as far as my 10-year-old self is concerned anyway, the only feeling I can remember from that distant time was the blessed relief of coming out of the dark and unmentionable sadness of my father's life and death into fragrance and greenness and light. Don't talk. Don't trust. Don't feel. Was the law we lived by, and woe to the one who broke it.
Remembering is an important part, I think, of spiritual growth, because if I'm right in this general thing I keep saying, that God speaks to us most eloquently, most powerfully, most irresistibly through what happens to us, and we forget what's happened to us, we've forgotten the words that have been spoken to us from on high. I think that's the most important part of remembering.
I had happy times as a child before Bermuda, but the times I remember best from those earlier before Bermuda years are mostly somber ones. My father moving from job to job, and his drinking, which changed him from a gentle, conscientious man to a flamboyant, fragmented man. And my mother, with her discontent and her terrible tongue, and worst of all, the appalling sound of their voices raised in anger as they fought about God only knows what, or to what dread and unimaginable end. Because we moved to a different town, a different house, a different school almost every year, those two people, my father and my mother, were the only fixed home I had. And I knew it if something awful happened between them or to them, the awful thing that was happening to me was that I would have no other place not only to go, but even to be. Oh, my father wrote in his note to my mother, "I love and adore you, but am no good." I can only assume he believed that we would be better off without him. And in a tragic way, he was right. In that way, his death was, as I suspect he intended it to be, his last, best gift to us. And also about the only gift he had left by then, to give.
You are your secrets.
you are what's happened to you. You're especially those things that happen to you at such a deep level and in such a sort of a explosive way that you kept them hidden all this time. And I think if you're ever to get out of, in a sense, the prison of your flesh, to where you can meet other souls who are living in other fleshes, you've got to start revealing who you are. 22 years later, in a novel called Return of Ansel Gibbs, long since forgotten, I told a very brief and fictionalized version of my father's death. And the most accurate word I can find to describe my mother's reaction to it is fury. For days, she could hardly bring herself to speak to me, and when she did, it was with words of great bitterness. As she saw it, I had betrayed a sacred trust. And though I might have defended myself by saying that the story was after all as much mine as his son to tell, as it was hers as his widow to keep hidden, I not only didn't say any such thing, but never even considered such a thing. I felt as much of a traitor as she charged me with being. And at the age of 32, was as horrified at what I had done as if I'd been a child of 10. I was full of guilt and remorse, and sure that in who knows what grim and lasting way I would be made to suffer for what I've done. I was in my 50s, and my mother in her 80s, before I dared write on the forbidden subject again. It was in an autobiographical book called The Sacred Journey that I did it. And this time I told the story straight, except that out of deference to my mother or in fear of my mother, I made no reference to her part in it. Otherwise, I set it down as fully and accurately as I could, and the only reason I was able to do so was I suspected that from Ansel Gibbs on, my mother had never really read any other book I'd written for fear of what she might find there. I was sure she wouldn't read this one either, and I turned out to be right. She never read the book, or the second autobiograph, the one that followed it, even though, or precisely because, it was the story of her son's life, and in that sense, her own story, too. She was a strong and a brave woman in many ways, but she was not brave or strong enough for that. We all have to survive the best we can.
I'm told by people who study dysfunctional families, one of the things that is one of the great prices you pay for being in a dysfunctional family is that law of the dysfunctional family, don't talk, don't trust, don't feel, becomes a sort of built-in law which you continue to obey long after that dysfunctional family has ceased to exist, but you carry it as part of your baggage. So it's good to loosen your tongue, I think.
It was in Florida that I started going to see another therapist, who was herself an adult child, like me, and whom I suppose for that reason I was able to listen to and learn from in ways that I hadn't found possible when I tried it 2 years earlier. And a lot of what she did, that woman, was not just to help me remember forgotten parts of my childhood and to recapture some of the feelings connected with those things which I had discovered as a child I should forget, but she also suggested certain techniques for doing that, recapturing the child I was. One such technique, I commend you all, was writing about those distant days with my left hand, my right hand. My right hand is my grown-up hand. It's a writer's hand. It's a minister's hand. But when I wrote with my left hand, I found that what tended to come out was as artless and basic as the awkward scrawl it came out in. It was as if some of my secrets had at last found a way of communicating with me directly. She suggested on one occasion that when I got home, I should try writing out a dialogue with my father, who died
a half a century before, a dialogue, using my left hand for his part and also for my part. And here's how part of it went. The child's me, the father is the man in the gray slacks and the maroon sweater. The child, how are you? Father, I'm fine. Child, a long time no see. Father, it's been a long time. Child, do you remember the last time we saw each other, Jamie and I, in Essex Fells, that morning in November? Father, I remember. How you were playing a game. Everybody was asleep. Child, were you scared, Daddy? How did you know what you were going to do? Father, I had to do it. Things were so bad, there wasn't any good way out. Child, could I have stopped you, Daddy? If I told you I loved you, if I told you I needed you? Father, no. Nobody could. I was lost so badly. Child, is this really you I'm talking to? I can't see your face. I've forgotten your face, your smell. Father, I remember you. I was proud of you. I wanted you to like me. Child, I've been so worried. I've been so scared ever since. Father, don't be. There's nothing to worry about. That's the secret I never knew, but I know it now. Child, what do you know, Daddy, my dearest dad and father? Father, I know plenty, and it's all good. I will see you again. Be happy for me. It's my birthday present to you. I loved you, boys. I love you still. Child, I love you. Goodbye for now, Father. So long, Fritz. Everything's going to be all right.
It takes a lot of courage to remember. And if the speaker who says, I can't remember, is just made aware that if you develop the courage, you can remember. And if you don't want to, it's probably too painful for you to come face to face with it. Try, little by little. And then finally those huge and unswallowable stones might be able to be lifted up.
My strong conviction is forgetfulness is the problem. And I think we have to constantly try to remember. We don't know anything unless we remember it. The great thing about being a human being is the way we do constantly remember. My father's death, which I keep going back to, which was a hideous moment for me as a child, as I've gone back and thought about it and seen the effect of it upon me and the silence of keeping it a secret upon me, I can see all the ways in which, in the long run, good things happened. I can bless it. It made me who I am, and I'm, by and large, not unhappy about who I am. This is part of the richness of what it was that created me at a terrible price, the price I never would have chosen to pay, God knows, but I can see how even through that darkness, God was at work. And I can forgive God if I blamed him for my father's death. Why didn't you say about it? I can forgive my father for running out on this. I can forgive myself for having been so turned in upon myself by it, because I see how out of it came good things, healing things.
what do you think about this central idea of opening up the secret and talking about it?
Yeah, I think that's got to be really relative to the situation. I mean, I've counseled with people, for instance, who have had an affair, and they've gotten over it, and it's all over, it's dead. And then they want to know whether they should tell their spouse about it. Mm-hmm. And then I ask, what good will that do? And it makes you feel better, or what, why, to what extent? Usually, I haven't had too many, but usually they've gotten to the point where they see that it might expiate some guilt. So I think Christian faith has other ways of dealing with it. But it sure wouldn't do a whole lot of good for the spouse, and particularly if they really have changed their behavior. And that promiscuity is no longer part of their life. I think we have almost a kind of compulsion in this society about all secrets are known. In fact, in one of the confession, it says, Almighty God, in whom all hearts are open, and from whom no secrets are hid. I can remember Joe Sittler saying, if all my secrets were known to everyone, I wouldn't even keep my job in Maywood. He thanked God that God alone knew his secrets. He lost some of that. And this rush to maybe therapy has said that to us, or we think that's therapeutic. I think in his case he had to talk about his father. I've got to talk about my father, write about him. My mother's 96. She didn't read my books before too much, so. And I haven't written that many great books or anything. But, a little suspicion.
Uh-huh.
Hey, is this trip necessary?
Yeah, one of the places I've read that really struck me, Harriet Lerner has a book called The Dance of Intimacy, in which she deals with intimacy, and she's concerned particularly about women. And she one of the cases she talks about there is a lesbian woman who decides that she really needs to come out to her family. And it doesn't work out at all the way she planned. Her parents just can't deal with it. And so, and what Lerner concludes is that it can be an act of courage to share a secret. It can also be an act of courage to keep the secret. And in some instances, it may work better in terms of what you want from certain relationships. So I think that example of the affair is a good one. Good one, too.
Isn't that kind of a question of what's the goal? Is telling secrets for its own sake, or is it for healing? And if it won't bring about healing, then telling the secrets can be destructive.
Yeah, and sometimes it's really hard to tell what's
right.
What's going to be the healing thing. And it may be good for me, and it may not be good for those that I... Yeah. But,
yeah. The very best relationship...
Go ahead, and then...
I just think of a couple of the very public disclosures that have been made by... some of the Hollywood, I can't think of their names now.
Patty Davis, Reagan's daughter.
Yeah, that's one. And then the one that disclosed that her parents, her father had sex with her, sister.
Who's Jackson?
The heavyset actress.
Oh, Roseanne.
Roseanne. I wonder sometimes whether that kind of disclosure. It might be good for the person that's disclosing it, but it's sure doing tragedy to
it's
so public.
That is a rather different kind of disclosure.
Yeah.
Well, although Buechner's being real public, isn't he? But but I do think the issue of things in the family that we can't talk about that are there can be a little different than the public sort of. Yeah,
I was just going to say the very best relationships are the ones with which we don't have to have secrets. but you really know who I am, and everything's okay. You love me with all my faults, and I love you with all your faults, and that is an ideal. We didn't get answers here, but we did discuss the risks that come, and you mentioned this one, we thought of job security and that sort of thing, and the tremendous risks that can come. And I give an example of my sister who, when she revealed she had cancer, lost some of her good friends. So there are risks, and, but it's sure wonderful when people can accept you with whatever your problems may be.
A couple of years ago, there was a speaker on sexual abuse and sexual acting out, and were referenced in the church as well as within families. And his statement was, a family or a person is as sick as their secrets. And that's remained with me as the level of dysfunction goes on. And in some cases, not telling secrets allows that dysfunction to continue from generation to generation. The person may, who therefore hasn't dealt with it, may act out either in that way or some other way. And there may be some therapeutic value, even though potential risk, in very many cases in talking through. I mean, even in the affair question, you know, I really resonate with that question, and I'm not sure the right answer is to tell either. But there, the affair is a symptom of an underlying problem. And that underlying problem may never be dealt with, and people may be going through the motions in a loveless relationship, and their children think that's what they should model. And they may never be healed as a couple, or know what intimacy with themselves or with God, therefore, can be. And so in a lot of ways, you know, it's so individual. You have whether you should take that risk or not. And the order not only to heal oneself once had an affair, but also to heal a relationship. You may think it's healed by covering it over, but I don't know whether by keeping that secret with one, there is a lack of intimacy. There is a place in which they're not meeting and never will, as long as that secret is there. That one will have to hold that within them. It may be an act of courage also.
Well, there's the bell, and we should quit, but thank you, and I appreciate the discussion and the insight into this issue, and I hope Beekner helps you think about your stories.